Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 849, Walking the Snake in Ukraine, part 6. This has been recorded on June 7th of the year 2015. Once again, we are going to be taking a look at the Orwellian coverage of the Ukrainian crisis in the U.S., Canada, in Ukraine itself, and elsewhere. And the title, of course, is a reference to the Nazi Cracked Serpent's Walk, published by National Vanguard Books. As I have said before, I believe that that book is much more than just the novel it purports to be. I think it is a blueprint for what is to take place and a manifesto. In that book, the SS go underground at the end of World War II, which we know to be true. They build up their economic muscle, which we know to be true. Witness the Bormann Capital Organization. And you can read the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, or download it for free on the SpitfireList.com website. They buy into the opinion-forming media, infiltrate the U.S. Military, and after the U.S. is decimated by a series of terrorist attacks using WMDs, the SS, basically martial law is declared, and the SS, the Nazis, the Underground Reich, take over the U.S. Key to the entire scenario presented in Serpent's Walk is the control of the opinion-forming media. Basically, they are cast in a pro-Nazi vein, and over time, the history of World War II and the Third Reich in particular is altered to make the Third Reich into heroes or good guys and the Allies into bad guys, the Jews in particular. What we are seeing in Ukraine and in connection with that is very much like what we are seeing, what we have seen in Serpent's Walk. And that is what I am talking about. And if that seems fanciful, well, just take a look at what is taking place there. I will cover as much of it as I have time for in this hour. Note that there are many other things that are taking place. I will cover those, the actual events, next week in For the Record 850. The U.S. military is now training, apparently, the Azov Battalion, among other Nazi military formations in Ukraine, which is as sad and depressing as it is infuriating at another level. However, the coverage of Ukraine is absolutely Orwellian. Indeed, in For the Record 781 and 782, I basically talked about the coverage of Ukraine in the context of George Orwell's 1984. And in For the Record program number 784, I talked again about, I titled that from a quote by Adolf Hitler, "First, tame the intellectuals, then take them to the fields and hitch them to your racehorses." And that is basically being done now. And in terms of walking the snake in Ukraine and the utter perversion of political and, in particular, historical reality in a pro-Nazi, pro-SS fashion, well, stay tuned. We're going to begin by reviewing a short section of an article that we used last week in For the Record 848, Walking the Snake in the Baltic States. This is from the Allgemeiner blog, Algemeiner, of January 31st of 2012. It is by Per, P-E-R, Anders, A-N-D-E-R-S, Rudling, R-U-D-L-I-N-G, the Waffen-SS as freedom fighters. And what this talks about is the political rehabilitation of the 14th Waffen-SS Division, which was a Ukrainian Waffen-SS Division. They are now being cast both in Ukraine and elsewhere as heroes, as freedom fighters, and the Canadian government is participating in this. Skipping down in the article. Outside of Europe, Waffen-SS veterans have been more successful in gaining acceptance for their own narrative. In Canada, government authorities, in the name of multiculturalism, have agreed to share the construction cost for monuments with the Association of the Ukrainian Veterans of the 14th Waffen Grenadier Division SS, or 1st Ukrainian, better known as the Waffen SS Galician. Public institutions of higher education institute endowments in the honor of Ukrainian Waffen SS volunteers. Again, the Canadian government absorbing part of the cost for monuments commemorating the heroism of the 14th Waffen SS Division, and institutions of higher education are basically capitalizing endowments in honor of the Ukrainian Waffen SS Division. Now, again, if people, and I can appreciate, particularly for newer listeners, if they think that my repeated use of the Nazi-cracked Serpent's Walk or my discussion of Orwell is somehow misplaced or over the top, well, just look at what is taking place. It is quite remarkable. And in that same vein, from the zik.ua blog of April 9th of 2015, Rada, by the way, R-A-D-A, is the Ukrainian parliament. Rada recognizes OUN and UPA members as fighters for independence of Ukraine. The OUN, by the way, is the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, headed up by Stefan Bandera, and the UPA is its military wing, the Ukrainian Partisan Army. Both were military allies and political allies of Nazi Germany in World War II, and carried out the Nazi ethnic cleansing in Ukraine during World War II. The UPA also continued guerrilla warfare with some of their Wehrmacht and Waffen-SS officers under the auspices of the Office of Policy Coordination until the early 1950s. We talked about that in AFA program number one, and we reviewed that in For the Record program 777. Another organization that has been resuscitated in Lithuania is the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union, that also was apparently allied with the Third Reich and participated in some of the Third Reich atrocities, and also then was funded and worked under the auspices of the Office of Policy Coordination and Frank Wisner. And again, the story from the zik.ua blog of April 9th of 2015, Rada recognizes OUN and UPA members as fighters for independence of Ukraine. Quote, the state acknowledges that the fighters for Ukraine's independence played an important role in reinstating the country's, The state acknowledges that the fighters for Ukraine's independence played an important role in reinstating the country's statehood declared on August 24, 1991, the law runs. In compliance with the law, the government will provide social guarantees and bestow honors on OUN-UPA fighters. Public denunciation of the role of OUN-UPA in restoring the independence of Ukraine is illegal, unquote, the law says. And again, this is noteworthy because it says public denunciation of the role of OUN-UPA in restoring the independence of Ukraine is illegal. Well, Ukraine was not, quote, independent, unquote, in World War II. And the forces that have come to power as a result of the very obvious covert operation in Ukraine are basically these same Third Reich allied institutions. And it is, again, it is simply Orwellian or walking the snake to make criticizing those institutions illegal. These are fascist institutions. And yet, now in Ukraine, criticizing them is illegal. It's worth noting that in another article talking about this, the law was actually introduced by a guy named Yuri Shukhevich. I've been mispronouncing Roman Shukhevich's name. I've been pronouncing it Shukhevich. I'm probably mispronouncing many of these Ukrainian names. Yuri Shukhevich fought with the UPA and introduced this law. Again, it makes criticizing Third Reich allied political and military institutions. It basically criminalizes criticizing that. It is absolutely Orwellian, and it is a classic example of walking the snake in Ukraine. Another article talking about this. This is from the Nation magazine of April 13th of 2015. Will Ukraine's new anti-communist law usher in a free speech dark ages? By Alec, A-L-E-C, L-U-H-N is his last name. And it talks about the law, which criminalizes basically almost any reference to Ukraine's Soviet past or any reference to its communist affiliations under the Soviet Union, including, by the way, the display of any military medals by elderly veterans of the Red Army in connection with the fight against the Third Reich. Skipping down in this to give one an idea, and even though what we are about to read, this is an observation by a guy named David Marples, M-A-R-P-L-E-S, who is a history professor at the University of Alberta in Canada, and he criticizes this, and yet the psychopolitical, to coin the term, cachet around this is such that basically documented political and historical reality about World War II are cast as Russian propaganda. Listen very carefully, skipping down. David Marples, a history professor specializing in Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine at the University of Alberta, called the law a, quote, crude distortion of the past, unquote, that lumps controversial nationalist organizations like the UPA together with less ruthless ones, lending credence to Kremlin claims that the Kiev government is run by nationalists. And he goes on to say, presumably now, historians can be arrested for denying the heroism of nationalist Stefan Bandera, or the father, a.k.a. Yuri, of the introducer of the bill, UPA leader Roman Shukhevich. Marples wrote in a blog post, quote, Russian trolls operating on social networks, very prominently featured in Western media over the past week, have now acquired new and authentic ammunition for their verbal arsenals, unquote. This is very subtle because, again, it's saying that, you know, well, this is bad because it's giving ammunition, even though it says, yes, it's valid, it's giving ammunition to Russian trolls, etc., etc. The late George Seldes, one of America's greatest investigative reporters and a brilliant anti-fascist journalist himself, observed that, quote, even the gods can't change history, but the Ministry of Truth can bloody well change history and has done just that. This would be similar if Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, were saying that 2 + 2 = 4 in the West and in Ukraine in particular. They would be saying that 2 + 2 = 7. And Marples is saying here that Russian trolls are prominently featured in Western social media, now have ammunition for their argument that 2 + 2 = 4. Well, 2 + 2 damn well equals 4, and the OUN and the UPA and the Bandera and the 14th Waffen-SS Division have the history that they have. It is not Russian or Soviet propaganda that they were Third Reich allies. And when you have the Azov Battalion, for example, wearing the SS rune and the swastika on their helmets, and now, according to articles in Stars and Stripes, among other publications, receiving training from the U.S., this is not Russian propaganda. However, that is how it is being cast. And I did not, well, I lived through part of the McCarthy period as an infant, but I was not of the age of awareness, so to speak. I was a tiny kid. What I am seeing is very much like what must have taken place during the McCarthy period, because we are now experiencing sort of a neo-McCarthyism and a new Cold War. And I would point out that Russia is not communist.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Another, some of the best coverage of our horrifying media portrayal of events in Ukraine has been from Robert Perry of Consortium News. That's, by the way, P-A-R-R-Y, not P-E-R-R-Y. And he did a two-part series on the Australian 60 Minutes program, not to be confused with the CBS program in the U.S. of the same name. They did a propaganda piece, in essence, in which they purported to confirm that the shootdown of MH17, that was a Malaysian airliner, was in fact done by a Buk, Russian-built anti-aircraft missile, that's spelled B-U-K, and that it was fired by pro-Russian separatists and then headed back into Russia. And Robert Perry did a very courageous two-part analysis of this. The links and much of the text are available in the description for the Record program number 849. Due to the limitations of time, I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I will talk about this right now. Some of it, anyway. What Robert Perry quite correctly is doing is characterizing this piece as what is known in journalism as a stand-upper. From the Consortium News website of May 28th of 2015, a reckless stand-upper on MH17 by Robert Perry, P-A-R-R-Y. It reads in part as follows. In the introduction, Australia's 60 Minutes claimed to do an investigative report showing the anti-aircraft battery that shot down Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 last July fled into Russia and pinning that atrocity on Russian President Putin. But the news show did a meaningless, quote, stand-upper, unquote, not an investigation, writes Robert Perry. And it reads in part, in TV journalism, there is a difference between doing a stand-upper and doing an investigative report, although apparently Australia's 60 Minutes doesn't understand that distinction. A stand-upper is the TV practice of rushing a correspondent to a scene to read some prepared script or state some preordained conclusion. An investigation calls for checking out facts and testing out assumptions. That investigative component is especially important if you're preparing to accuse someone of a heinous crime, say mass murder, even if the accused is a demonized figure like Russian President Vladimir Putin. Such charges should not be cast about casually. Indeed, it is the job of journalists to show skepticism in the face of those sorts of accusations. In the case of Russia, there's the other possible complication that biased journalism and over-the-top propaganda could contribute to a nuclear showdown. We are still living with the catastrophe of the mainstream media going with the flow of false claims about Saddam Hussein and Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Now, many of the same media outlets are parroting similar propaganda aimed at Russia without demonstrating any independence and asking tough questions, although the consequences now could be even more catastrophic. That is the context of my criticism of Australia's 60 Minutes handling of the key video evidence supposedly implicating Russia and Putin in the July 17, 2014 shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine. It is apparent from the show's original much-hyped presentation and a 3-minute-plus follow-up that the show and its correspondent Michael Usher failed to check out the facts surrounding an amateur video allegedly showing a Buk anti-aircraft missile battery missing one missile after the MH-17 shootdown. In the days following the tragedy killing 298 people, Ukrainian government officials promoted the video on social media as supposedly showing the Buk battery making its getaway past a billboard in Krasnodon, that's K-R-A-S-N-O-D-O-N, a town southeast of Luhansk, allegedly en route toward Russia. That claim primarily came from Ukraine's Interior Minister Arsen Avakov, considered one of the regime's most right-wing figures who rose to power after a U.S.-backed coup in February of 2014. From a journalistic standpoint, Avakov and the other Kiev authorities should have been considered biased observers. Indeed, they were among the possible suspects for the shootdown. Moreover, the Russian government placed the video's billboard in the town of Krasnoarmeysk, that's K-R-A-S-N-O-A-R-M-I-I-S, apostrophe K, northwest of Donetsk, and then under Ukrainian government control. To support that claim, the Russians cited a local address on the billboard, skipping down. In the initial program, you see the 60 Minutes team doing exactly that on some videos of Russia's significance by superimposing some of its own shots over amateur footage. However, when it came to the key piece of evidence, the quote, getaway, unquote, video, the program deviated from that pattern. Instead of matching anything up, Usher just did a, quote, stand upper, end quote, in front of one of the billboards. Usher boldly accused the Russians of lying about the location of the billboard and asserted that he and his team had found the real location. Usher gestured to the billboards on the intersection in rebel-controlled Luhansk. He then accused Putin of responsibility for the 298 deaths. But none of Usher's images matched up with the getaway video. The scene in the video was clearly different from the scene shown by Usher. After several people sent me the segment in Australia's 60 Minutes, I watched it and wrote an article noting the obvious problems in the scene as presented. My point was not to say where the video was shot. As far as I know, it might even have been shot in Luhansk. My point was that Usher and his team had failed to do their investigative duty to verify the location as precisely as possible. Under principles of English-based law and of Western journalism, there is a presumption of innocence until sufficiently corroborated evidence is presented. The burden of proof rests on the prosecutors, or in this case, the journalists. It's not enough to guess at these things. But Usher and his team treated their job like they were just doing a stand-upper, putting Usher in front of some billboards in Luhansk to deliver his conclusions or those of English blogger Higgins, not as an investigative assignment which would have skeptically examined the assumptions behind citing that location on the scene in the video. There is much more here, and there is a link to Robert Perry's initial analysis of this. I would point out that in past discussion of the shootdown of MH Flight 17, he has pointed out that some U.S. photo reconnaissance experts have identified the apparent missile battery that shot the plane down as having been manned by a possibly drunken Ukrainian soldiers. That's not Russian-backed separatists, but Ukrainian military personnel. It may very well have been a provocation. I also noted that at roughly that time, President Putin's airliner was headed back through that roughly same segment of airspace, whether they were trying to kill Putin or whether they were trying to stage a provocation remains to be seen. This, however, is once again an example of the Ministry of Truth or of walking the snake. There is no discussion of that. We will talk more about a guy named Michael Bashirku, B-O-C-I-U-R-K-I-W. I'm probably mispronouncing that. He is the head of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's special study mission in Ukraine. He was also the former editor of the Canadian-based Ukrainian Weekly, which is an unabashed pro-OUNB publication. And he also is networked with Malaysian Muslim Brothers that are linked to the same milieu that figures in the disappearance of the Malaysian Airlines flight that disappeared in March of 2014. We talked about that in some of our other coverage of the Ukrainian crisis. But again, do note Robert Perry's incisive and courageous picking on of that piece of propaganda, which has been embraced, by the way, by the Ukrainian government. They apparently are very angry with Robert Perry, that is to say the Australian 60 Minutes program, and have taken him to task for that. One of the aspects of the coverage of Ukraine in the U.S. and the Western media has been an almost giddy or adolescent orientation towards political analysis and journalism. I often think, frankly, at least as far as the U.S. goes, and I'm afraid this now goes for an awful lot of the West, the U.S. is like a gigantic high school with a multi-trillion-dollar budget and nuclear weapons. Much of American civil society behaves like people in the movie Mean Girls. It really, there's a very adolescent quality to what is going on, even to the point of President Obama and others saying we have to isolate Russia. That's a way nasty and not particularly well-adjusted teenagers behave towards someone they want to malign socially. They isolate the person. That can be quite hurtful to adolescents, but there is a really, again, a giddy adolescent quality to the Western coverage of Ukraine, and there is nothing, I think, that exemplifies that more dramatically and also exemplifies the fundamental perversion of political and social reality as far as what is going on in Ukraine than the French edition of Elle magazine and their coverage of a young Ukrainian woman named Vita Zavaruka. Again, I'm probably mispronouncing that. Her name is spelled V-I-T-A-Z-A-V-R-U-K-H-A. And then in their initial coverage of Ms. Zavaruka, she was shown in her military garb. She is a member of the Volunteer or Punisher battalions, including Azov. She's actually a member of the Adar battalion. And they are some of these Nazi and fascist paramilitary formations that are now receiving U.S. military training courtesy of the United States taxpayer. And initially, Elle magazine had dubbed her sort of a Joan of Arc of Ukraine. She actually is not only a member of the Adar Punisher Battalion, but is a neo-Nazi and a cop killer. And coverage of this is from the, an expose of this is from the Daily Mail in the UK, an article co-authored by Will Stewart and Flora Drury, D-R-U-R-Y, from the Daily Mail of May 8th of 2015. Teenage girl soldier hailed as Ukraine's Joan of Arc by Elle magazine is revealed as neo-Nazi and is arrested over cop killing.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
The Daily Mail article reads, in part, "A neo-Nazi portrayed as Ukraine's version of Joan of Arc by French fashion magazine Elle for her, quote, brave, unquote, fight against the Russian separatists has been arrested in connection with the death of two policemen. Vita Zavaruka was taken into custody after two officers were killed and three more injured on May 4th following a gang's failed attempt to rob a petrol station in the capital, Kiev. The gang, who all have links to the far right in Ukraine and allegedly were involved in a shootout as they tried to flee the scene. At first glance, It seems shocking that this slight blonde teenager could be involved at all. But Vita, 19, is charged with, quote, an attempt on an officer of the law, reported news outlets in Moscow, and a quick search reveals she is an active promoter and supporter of vile neo-Nazi ideals. What's more, she is also suspected of being linked to an attack on a traffic police post in Bykovnia 2 days beforehand, and it is also claimed that she participated in bloody attacks on the Odessa House of Trade Unions in May of last year, in which 46 perished and 200 were injured. Yet just 6 months ago, Elle magazine's French edition was portraying her as a Joan of Arc type figure, bravely defending her home from Russian separatists, taken in, it seems, by her innocent appearance, skipping down. But the magazine's mistake was quickly picked up. Vita is a well-known member of the Adar Battalion, which last September was slammed by Amnesty International for its campaign of terror through the war-torn Luhansk region. Among the 400-strong volunteer unit's alleged crimes were abductions, unlawful detention, ill-treatment, theft, extortion, and possible executions. The battalion is known for its links to the far right, and members have previously been pictured with Nazi insignia. But it is Vita's VK page, the Russian equivalent of Facebook, which provides unequivocal evidence of her own extreme views. Pictures of the blonde teenager performing the Nazi salute, posing in a T-shirt covered in the fascist's emblems, and even decorating her tent with a colorful swastika populate the page, while pictures she shares include things like Ukraine with Yids, unquote. What Vita, who says she is, quote, Adar from the beginning, unquote, I will continue to be so, writes on the page, makes her vile views even more startlingly obvious. Quote, I promote Nazism, terror, and genocide, she wrote in December of last year. For all of this, I am not a bad person. The justification is the war for peace. If you go bringing the work to its end, only in this case justify my actions would not the best English. Winners are not judged. Ekaterina Roshuk, R-O-S-H-U-K, former managing director at the Kiev Times, claimed Zavoruka had, quote, long terrorized the city with no one able to do anything about her. The police were afraid to touch a hero of the anti-terrorist operation, which in turn was used as license to engage in lawlessness, unquote. Skipping down. Vesti reported that Vita's four male accomplices were also members of volunteer battalions fighting in the country's eastern conflict zone. They were named as Vadim Pinus, P-I-N-U-S, 23, a decorated Azov battalion fighter who was killed in the shootout with police, Evgeny Koshelyuk, K-O-S-H-E-L-Y-U-K, 20, a sniper, and Andrei Romanyuk, 17, and Nikolai Monashenko, M-O-N-I-S-H-E-N-K-O, also 17. So again, this sort of giddy adolescent rush to find marketable media figures in that will justify the general perversion of political and historical reality in Ukraine. Well, I don't think anything exemplifies that better than Ms. Zavoruka. There are some pictures that are included in the description of the website to show her. Again, she's very young. She's only 19. And she has posed in a tank top with an eagle and a swastika. And she's Joan of Arc, I guess. They're just not making those saints like they used to. My feeling when seeing that, I'm reminded of Gandhi's quip. He was asked by a Western journalist what he thought of Western civilization, and Gandhi responded, the quote, I think it would be a good idea, unquote. And that is sort of my feeling about walking the snake in Ukraine and the anointing of little Nazi cop killer Vita Zavoruka as Ukraine's Joan of Arc. Another example of the sort of neo-McCarthyite, Orwellian, and Serpent's Walk phenomenon is the political attack and professional destruction of people who are supportive of a critical view of Ukraine. And anyone who dares to differ with the policy in the West or Russia or the portrayal of Ukraine as just a flowering of democracy being crushed by Russian authoritarianism, blah, 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 completely ignoring the fascist nature of the forces that have manifested there. Well, it's not just political figures, it's not just journalists, and we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. It is also cultural figures. Now, again, I mentioned that the Ukrainian Weekly's former assistant editor, a guy named Michael Bashurku, is now head of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's special study mission in Ukraine. He is not only networked with the OUNB networks, or milieu, I should say, but also is networked with a Malaysian Muslim Brotherhood milieu that is connected not only to Operation Green Quest and some of the terror funding and Muslim Brotherhood forces that were exposed there, linked to the GOP, but also is linked to the disappearance of a Malaysian airliner in March of 2014. The pilot of that plane was a political protege of former Malaysian brother and Malaysian President Anwar Ibrahim, who was a consulting client of Grover Norquist. Now in Canada, as the Ministry of Truth extends its reach to cultural affairs, and as the snake is walked into cultural affairs, the Ukrainian Weekly, formerly having its assistant editor as Michael Bashurku, is front and center. This is from the Star of Canada from April 7th of 2015 by Thomas Walcom, W-A-L-K-O-M. Pianist punished for daring to challenge political orthodoxy in Ukraine. Walcom, W-A-L-K-O-M. And this reads in part, "Surely it is enough that Canadian politicians have taken sides in Ukraine's bitter conflict. All three major parties in Parliament agree that Ukraine's central government in Kiev is heroic and that Eastern rebels battling it are mere cat's paws of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Must we now punish any piano player who dares to dissent? Apparently, the management of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra thinks we should. It has canceled two performances this week by U.S. pianist Valentina Lisitsa, L-I-S-I-T-S-A, simply because it doesn't like her position on Ukraine. Symphony managers apparently didn't realize that Kiev-born Lisitsa has definite views on political developments in her native Ukraine. Nor do they seem to realize that the politically powerful Ukrainian-Canadian establishment finds these views outrageous." Skipping down. In a Facebook posting this week, Lisitsa describes herself as someone who initially supported last year's revolution in Kiev, saying she hoped the so-called Maidan movement would rid Ukraine of its corrupt oligarchic ruling class. But she writes, "She soon became disillusioned when the same oligarchs commandeered the revolution and, in her words, started to turn Ukrainians against one another." Her critics, of which there are many, say she never supported an independent Ukraine and has always been a Russian stooge. To supporters of the Ukrainian central government, however, she was an abomination. Skipping down. The Ukrainian Weekly was also outraged when, in another tweet, she referred to Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko as, quote, "cluster bomber-in-chief," unquote. By the way, various human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, have accused the Ukrainian government of using cluster bombs in the civil war there. Continuing, "And the publication was beside itself when she reprinted a cartoon depicting the Western media's coverage of Ukraine as a daisy chain of individuals with their heads up one another's rectums." Critics also objected to a tweet regarding a battle in eastern Ukraine in which she wrote, "Kiev kills scores of civilians," unquote. And then they attacked her for observing that some who support Ukraine's central government are neo-Nazis. In retaliation, supporters of the Ukrainian government picketed her appearance last fall at Pittsburgh's Heinz Hall. They carried signs suggesting she was a Nazi and calling her racist. Skipping down. Buoyed by this success, the Ukrainian Weekly now has set its sights on two other Western concert performers deemed overly sympathetic to Russia. The ground war in Ukraine sputters on. The ideological purges here are just beginning. This reminds me a little bit of the Hollywood blacklisting and the Hollywood 10, which basically artists and cultural figures are being professionally blackballed or certainly harassed for their political views. And again, apparently the Ukrainian Weekly is front and center. Though I will remind people that last year Russia introduced a resolution in the UN General Assembly condemning the celebration of fascist collaborators as freedom fighters, something we are now seeing in the Baltic states and in Ukraine. And the German arm twisting, basically Germany abstained and twisted arms of the other EU members. Something like 130, maybe 135 countries voted in favor of the resolution, but only three voted against it. One, of course, was Ukraine, another was the U.S., and another was Canada. And as we looked at the beginning of the program, as we saw, I should say, the Canadian government is sharing the cost of monuments commemorating the 14th Waffen-SS Division as heroes of Ukrainian independence, and Canadian, Freudian slip, Ukrainian institutions of higher education are basically giving endowments in favor, basically endowments lauding, in educational endowments, lauding the 14th Waffen-SS as heroes. Again, this is more than a little grotesque. From the op-ed news of March 19th of 2015, we find a post by George Eliason, who's done some very good work. He's an American-born journalist who resides in Ukraine and, among other things, creates websites. And he's talking about the information warfare that is being managed in Ukraine by an American intelligence officer and former Special Forces officer, and speculates about the possible extension of that information warfare to the U.S. This article is called "Can the Ukrainian Government Target American Journalists in America?" by George Eliason. That's E-L-I-A-S-O-N. If you are a journalist writing about or a person concerned about issues like free speech, read or write in alternative media, or news, Occupy movement, Ferguson, Gaza, Ukraine, Russia, police brutality, U.S. interventionism, fair government, homelessness, keeping the government accountable, representative government, government intrusions like the NSA is doing, or you are liberal, progressive, libertarian, conservative, separation of church and state, religion, and then skipping down, if you have a website, write, read, or like something in social media that strays outside the new lines, the war isn't coming, it's now here. And he quotes this U.S. intelligence officer and former Special Forces operative, a very formidable and intelligent individual named Joel Harding. Tragically, someone who not too long ago seemed to be aware of the extent of Western and U.S. government deception, but has sort of fallen in line. Maybe, he has a new job and is being well paid. He is now helping to direct the Ukrainian government's information warfare, information operations. And he is quoted here on Ukraine's cyber strategy. What will we do? Disrupt, deny, degrade, deceive, corrupt, usurp, or destroy the information. The information, please don't forget, is the ultimate objective of cyber. That will directly impact the decision-making process of the adversary's leader, who is the ultimate target, unquote.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free.
And in the next section of Elias's post, welcome to the world of private sector I.O. information operations. I.O. or I.I.O., inform and influence operations, are defined by the U.S. Army and include the fields of psychological operations and military deception. Military I.I.O. operations center on the ability to influence foreign audiences, U.S. and global audiences, and adversely affect enemy decision-making through an integrated approach. Even current event news is released in this fashion. Each portal is given messages that follow the same themes because it is an across-the-board mainstream effort that fills the information space entirely when it is working correctly. The purpose of inform and influence operations is not to provide a perspective, opinion, or lay out a policy. It is defined as the ability to make audiences think and act in a manner favorable to the mission objectives. This is done through applying perception management techniques which target the audience's emotions, motives, and reasoning. These techniques are not geared for debate. It is to overwhelm and change the target psyche. Using these techniques, information sources can be manipulated, and those that write, speak, or think counter to the objectives are relegated as propaganda, ill-informed, or irrelevant. He then talks about Joel Harding, whom Eliasson alleges is in charge of the Ukrainian information operations. According to his own bio, Joel spent 26 years in the U.S. Army. His first 9 years were spent as an enlisted soldier, mostly in special forces, as a special forces qualified communicator and medic on an A-team. After completing his degree, Joel then received his commission as an infantry officer and, after 4 years, transitioned to the Military Intelligence Corps. In the mid-1990s, Joel was working in the Joint Staff J-2 in support of special operations, where he began working in the new field called information operations. Eligible receiver 1997 was his trial by fire. After that, he became the Joint Staff J-2 liaison for I.O. to the CIA, DIA, NSA, DISA, and other assorted agencies in the Washington, D.C. area, working as the intelligence lead on the Joint Staff I.O. response cell for Solar, Sunrise, and Moonlight Maze. Joel followed this by a tour at SOCCENT, S-O-C-C-E-N-T, and then INSCOM, working in both I.O. and intelligence. Joel retired from the Army in 2003, working for various large defense contractors until accepting the position with the Association of Old Crows. According to Tech Republic, the career of Joel Harding, the director of the group's Old Crows Information Operations Institute, exemplifies the increasing role that computing and the Internet are playing in the military. A 20-year veteran of military intelligence, Mr. Harding shifted in 1996 into one of the earliest commands that studied government-sponsored computer hacker programs. After leaving the military, he took a job as an analyst at SAIC, a large contractor developing computer applications for military and intelligence operations. It then goes on to more of his CV, which is very impressive. He is a very intelligent, accomplished, and formidable individual, and then apparently was hired to direct Ukraine's information operations. And it also quotes him here as being very skeptical of the quality of U.S. government information. And he was aware that the U.S. government, basically in 2012 anyway, Joel Harding certainly appears to have been aware that the U.S. government distorts information, as does many totalitarian regimes as well. Indeed, we're moving in that direction. Skipping down, Joel Harding has quite a different opinion in 2014 after taking control of information operations, or I.O., in Ukraine. Part of USIA formed what is now called the Broadcasting Board of Governors, the BBG, who oversee VOA, RFE, RL, RFA, MEBN, Radio Marquis, and other international broadcasting bureaus. Their mission is to broadcast fair and objective reporting, what I call denied areas such as Russia. February 22, 2014, marks Harding's first involvement in the Ukrainian crisis. Quote, yesterday I agreed to help present the information of this situation, bringing in representatives from many of the sources cited above. It is time international broadcasting is examined. On February 28, 2014, he was announced director of the NSE Strategy Center. Harding reached out immediately to the IO community to see what information anyone had on current Russian cyberspace operations. On March 1, 2014, Harding announced cyber operations for Ukraine. And again, exactly what can be done, what is being done, is past the point something of a topic for speculation. I would note that Robert Perry's Consortium News website at one point was hampered by apparently sort of a denial of service attack in the comments section, whether that was in any way connected with the Ukrainian IO operation and or Joel Harding is a matter of speculation. But again, Robert Perry's Consortium News website has been one of the relatively few websites that has been willing to break from the media lockdown vis-a-vis the reinstitution of the old OUNB and UPA fascists in Ukraine. Something very similar is afoot in the U.S. This again from The Nation magazine of June 8th of 2015, Neo-McCarthyism and the U.S. Media, unquote. The crusade to ban Russia policy critics. As a result of the civil war that has raged in Ukraine since April of 2014, at least 7,000 people have been killed and more than 15,400 wounded, many of them grievously. And it goes on to talk about the sources that have credibly reported that. And yet a special report published last fall by the online magazine The Interpreter would have us believe that Russian, quote, disinformation, unquote, ranks among the gravest threats to the West. The report titled The Menace of Unreality, How the Kremlin Weaponized Information, Culture, and Money is a joint project of The Interpreter and the Institute for Modern Russia, or IMR, a Manhattan-based think tank funded by the exiled Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Co-written by the journalists Michael Weiss and Peter Pomerantsev, this highly political manifesto makes the case for why the U.S. and the West generally must combat what the authors allege to be the Kremlin's extravagantly designed propaganda campaign. If implemented, the measures they propose would stifle democratic debate in the Western media. The report seeks to awaken a purportedly somnolent American public to the danger posed by the Kremlin's media apparatus. According to Weiss and Pomerantsev, the Russian government via RT, the Kremlin-funded international television outlet, as well as a network of, quote, expatriate NGOs and, quote, far-left and far-right movements, unquote, is creating an anti-Western authoritarian international that is becoming ever more popular throughout the world. While it would be easy to dismiss the report as a publicity stunt by two journalists attempting to cash in on the Russophobia so in vogue among American pundits, their thesis has gained wide acceptance, nowhere more so than in the halls of Congress. And again, there's a link to the entire article and much more text is available. And skipping down still further in this, the report asserts that Putin's Russia is, quote, arguably more dangerous than a communist superpower, unquote. Any effective response to the virus of Russian propaganda, Weiss insists, must combine, quote, the wisdom of Orwell with the savvy of Don Draper, unquote. Readers will certainly see that the duo has led by example, since the report and its modest recommendations, unquote, are nothing if not Orwellian. The authors call for the creation of, quote, an internationally recognized rating system for disinformation, unquote, that would furnish news organizations and bloggers with the, quote, analytical tools with which to define forms of communication, unquote. While they throw in an obligatory caveat that, quote, top-down censorship should be avoided, unquote, exactly how is left unexplained, they nonetheless endorse what amounts to a media blacklist, unquote. And goes basically on, and it notes basically this is slouching toward McCarthyism, and the article concludes, one would have hoped that journalists of all people would object to this project in the strongest possible terms. That no one has yet done so is an ominous sign. Indeed it is. And I would also note another interesting thing. A columnist named Anne Applebaum for the Washington Post is arguing for the elimination of anonymity for comments posted to either news articles or blogs. It's called Another Reason to Avoid Reading the Comments by Anne Applebaum from the Washington Post of November 28th of 2014. I have to confess that to an extent I do share her distaste for anonymous comments. If the comment is substantive, in other words, if it has documentation, a link to an article or something, but just, you know, anonymous naysaying is something I don't have a lot of patience for. Having done many years as the host of a telephone-in talk show and having gotten very tired of having to say, I'm sorry, caller, the microphone is much too big, I share her distaste for that to an extent. The media, the internet, I should say, is a coward's paradise. However, if somebody is posting something that is substantive, well-documented, and controversial, I can certainly see the reasons for anonymity. And Applebaum, however, thinks that should be banned as well, which is not good. She also, by the way, is married to a prominent Polish politician. And again, Ms. Applebaum's comments, article, I should say, is in the written description for the program. Sort of as an indication of a hallmark of the degree of Orwellian and serpent's walk perversion of historical reality, an article, an Agence France Presse article in Yahoo News of March 19th of 2015, West rains on Putin's World War II parade as Ukraine's crisis takes toll. It's by Anna Smolchenko and Olga Rotenberg, and it talks about a Polish politician at the commemoration of the liberation of Auschwitz, saying it wasn't Soviet troops, it was Ukrainian troops who liberated Auschwitz. Briefly, presiding over preparations for the Russian-wide festivities this week, Putin said attempts to belittle Russia's role in World War II were aimed at stripping it of its moral authority, unquote. Quite true. Occasionally, we hear sheer lunacy. It is amazing how people even come to this. Poland angered Moscow when its foreign minister said it was, quote, Ukrainian soldiers rather than the Soviet Red Army who liberated Auschwitz in 1945. That is simply not true. What it was Red Army troops from the Ukrainian front. It was also the Belarusian front and others. That was a Red Army command bureaucratic distinction. They were not Ukrainian soldiers, that is to say, members of the UPA. They were Red Army soldiers, some of whom may very well have been Ukrainian extraction. But the fact that it was soldiers from the Ukrainian front who liberated Auschwitz doesn't mean that it was Ukrainian soldiers. And this is simply sheer BS. However, in the Orwellian Ministry of Truth and the neo-McCarthyite Serpent's Walk environment that we live in, I suspect that I think in 200 or 300 years, Adolf Hitler's birthday will be celebrated as an international holiday. A lot will happen between now and then, but we are on the way. This concludes For the Record 849, Walking the Snake in Ukraine, Part 6, being recorded on June 7th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.